today, Daniel, we're going to talk about the Portable Antiquity Scheme. It's a database, and as I remember a long time ago, it's been instigated by Roger Bland of the Medals and Coins and Medals Department. And obviously, Roger Bland went through the formation of the, or rejiggling of the Antiquity Act. 1997 or 1996, is it?
Yeah.
And of course that would make it quite imperative to record all the possible finds in the database, which gives us an extra context and the relationship between various objects in Wales, in England and Wales. Please, Daniel, so tell us all about it.
Thank you, Hafid. Thank you very much for coming to listen to me today. I've got a few colleagues in the room who know a little bit about the scheme as well. John at the back is married to one of our staff as well. Hopefully I won't get his students' work wrong as well, because I'm going to talk about Tom Brindle's work from King's College London as well. I'll give a chance to tell you a bit about the work we do, who works with us. It's going to be about 60 slides, but don't worry, it's not going to be 60 slides of me reading stuff out. There's lots of pictures and there's a few interesting maps. Well, I think they're interesting, you might not. So, let's just tell you about what the scheme does to start with. Well, we employ 56 people at the moment. We employ four more part-time as well. And we deal with public discovery of archaeology. So people go out into the community, they go into fields, they go into gardens, and they find objects, either by metal detecting, by gardening, by building, or just accidental discovery. So someone might be walking down a footpath and see something on the side of the footpath, pick it up and realise it's an object. There's one very famous object that the museum bought, the Kermel penny, which they spent £400,000 on buying, and that's found inside a footpath. Of course, everything belongs to someone in this country. It belongs to a landowner, belongs to the Crown, it's state property. So there's lots of issues involved over ownership. One of my colleagues here, Caroline, she deals with treasure. She has to chase up lots of landowners, lots of finders, and find out who actually owns the land. It's quite a cheap project in the grand scheme of things. It costs £1.4 million per year. So if you work out how much that costs per person to run or pay, it's not a huge amount of money. And my IT budget is £5,000 a year. I actually run the IT system. So £5,000 out of £1.4 million is rather small. The figures I've got up there are actually slightly wrong. I'm going to come to some better ones later. And we're funded by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. We're originally funded through the Museums, Libraries and Archives Council. They're about to disappear. Some people might say that's a good thing. So I try and be innovative in the work we do. This picture here, which on the left, is what the database looked like a few months ago. It's multi-period. I don't just deal with Roman objects, even though I like the Roman period. I don't really like prehistory, and I don't really like medieval stuff. So today's going to be a focus on Roman objects for you. So it integrates social media and third-party technology. I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on. I'm going to talk about how I leverage certain technology to try and make my database better, and it's all done very cheaply. So this is how much it costs to set up for the database. So I bought two servers 3 years ago, and they cost £6,000. That's quite expensive now, you can get them far cheaper. I paid someone £3,000 to set everything up for me in the server environment. That was to give a bit of support fees as well for the next 2 years. Now I do all of that work myself. And we spend £4,700 a year on server charges. Now, I haven't got very much money left for my £5,000 after that. So I haven't really done very much with money for what I've done. It costs $48 for 2 years for a Flickr license, and £13 per month for some feedback services, which I now cancel because they're a waste of time. No one actually used them. And the domain name costs £1.89 per year. So it's very cheap and very quick to actually build these websites. The British Museum gave me a grant of £10,000. I actually advertised for developers to help me, and I couldn't get one, so I built it myself. And the money went on buying the servers. So what's the point of collecting this data? Well, hopefully this talk might show you. If we don't collect this data, the knowledge is lost. We only get one chance to record the objects. Say Katie's sitting there, finds an object, and she goes and sells it. I've got no chance of ever getting that information back. If it goes into private collection, we don't know where it's gone. So it's really imperative that we record the information. Now, I talked about metal detecting earlier. It is legal in this country. I don't know if we've got foreign nationals in the room. In most countries, metal detecting is either really heavily regulated or banned completely. So there's several criteria that you have to remember in England, Wales, and Scotland. You need to have permission of the landowner. So Hafid might say, you can't go detecting my land. That means you should not go and recover anything. If you do, he could actually say you've committed theft. And he could go to the police and ask the objects to come back. They won't actually chase it up very often. We've got very toothless laws in this country for actually chasing people. and I think we had one prosecution under the Treasury Act, and that failed in the end under appeal, didn't it? There's 18,000 protected sites in the country, not allowed to protect from those either. 90% of the scheduled or sites that we know in the country aren't scheduled. So there's a lot of land that people can go on legally and find objects. And detectives do their research, much like archaeologists or you. They go and look at maps, they look at resources, and they'll find out where is going to be the best mining source for. You could say they're treasure hunters. They don't like that term. But we actually believe there's about 9,000 detectives in this country. Other people think there's 30,000. So there's a big discrepancy between figures, but we're sure it's about 9,000 after some surveys that we did. And it gets into popular media as well. Now, this came up after the Staffordshire Orb was found, and we expected a big explosion of metal detectorists. It didn't actually happen. So Matt puts a cartoon up, everyone thinks, oh, metal detecting, trendy. No, don't think so, really. One of the other big things about the scheme as well, we've reached classes that the government really wants us to deal with. We've reached people who are, as the government sees it, not very well educated, don't have much money, maybe on benefits. We've actually got lots of educated people out there who are detecting, and they are actually really interested in history, and they know far more than some of our staff. It's quite embarrassing sometimes, you go and talk to these detectorists, and they know far more about the objects than you do, and you're meant to be the specialist. So this gives you an idea of a breakdown by period. Now, as you're all classicists, I think you're probably most interested in the second from bottom one. We've got over 370,000 Roman objects in our database now. 37% of all objects in the database are coins. I quite like coins now. I hated them when I first started. They're logical, they've got information on them, it's portable, you can actually read inscriptions, you know who things belong to. When you've got an object, you might not know what it actually belongs to. You don't know where the buckles come from, or brooches. So you can try and write much more about things without being told you're wrong. You can actually write typologies and all sorts of stuff around the objects in our database. So this just gives you an idea of the volume of finds recorded. Now, some big peaks here, and there's a few troughs as well. So who can remember foot and mouth disease in this one? So you can see a dip around 2002 when people couldn't go out detecting. Now, my wife was at UCL at the time, and you were on field trips. You weren't allowed to go that year, which really annoyed her. So it's the same for detectorists. They couldn't go out in the fields and find things. So we were recording stuff that they found in the previous years. You then see a rise in 2003. This is when the scheme went national after 6 years of piloting. So we've got rapid expansion of objects being found. Then it sort of plateaus slightly, goes up again, then it goes back down. Now this relates to a review of the scheme in 2008 by Museums, Libraries and Archives Council. Our staff were very demoralised because they were told the scheme wasn't working very well, we were wasting money. So they stopped recording as much, thought there's no point doing much work, I'm going to look for another job. We also had some very serious problems with hardware with our previous supplier. They went bankrupt in 2007. We had an argument with the people who bought it, and they actually told us that the source code and all the information belonged to them, and we'd have to pay them £10,000 to get our stuff back. We managed to circumvent this by talking to the server company, and I went down to the server farm and moved the servers out of their cupboard, and then we started again. So in 2010, I relaunched the database, and you can see there's a big spike in recording again, so up to 90,000 objects a year. Now, in that year, I actually put on 233,000 objects. I've imported two data sets. Now, some of you might have heard of Celtic Coin Index, which is based at Oxford University. And there's also Peter Guest's project at Cardiff University, Iron Age and Roman Corpus of Wales. I imported that data as well, so that gave us another 130,000 objects. So we got a big jump. Obviously, we didn't record them, but they're still portable antiquities. So we've got them on our database. So you can now query them on our database as well and get a big picture of Wales. We've just been in the news as well. I think if you might have picked up paper yesterday or today, you might have seen this story about Roman civilization. I don't know why it's called Roman civilization in this story, because it's just one site in Devon that's being found. I can't tell you whereabouts it is, because it's under secret wraps. I think someone in this room knows where it is. So it gets into the BBC. And then there's a book going around as well, the Freem Hoard, it's a green book. Help us out to have a look at that. Now, this is a really interesting coin hoard that came up. It's the biggest one found in this country in a single pot. It weighs two of me. It's got 52,503 coins in it. They're mostly copper alloy. Then there's 10 silver denarii, I think. I can't remember off the top of my head. And it's a huge conservation cataloguing exercise. Now, Hafed mentioned my boss, Roger Bland, earlier. He's a chap in a nice green jumper at the back. And then there's Sam Moorhead, one of my other colleagues as well. Now, these are both numismatic geeks. They sit in the corner of a room and sort of rock backwards and forwards quite often when they're looking at coins. Roger actually licks coins when he's identifying them as well, so he can actually see what details on them. And he came out with a really green tongue and green fingers and starts feeling rather real after doing this board. Can we get to say to stop licking the coins? You're looking a bit ill. And he suddenly realised it was the coins making him ill, so he stopped doing it. So you can see some of the coins there. This is a publicity shot, just with one of the denarii of Carausius. And they make quite nice photos for the press. Now, this was at a press launch at Froom Library, where all these people turned up into the community. They got no interest in the objects originally. They found out they found their community. So they came along in droves to actually see Roger and Sam talk about the objects. So people are really interested in archaeology. Last Friday, I think it was last Friday, Lorna, who's here, set up a project about Day of Archaeology. And we got 400 archaeologists to write stuff online. And so people are interested in archaeology. There's lots of people out there doing archaeology. We've got to tap into them. And one of the big missions of the scheme is actually to go out to the community and make people interested in archaeology. So we give lectures and talks, much like this. So we go out to clubs and metal detecting rallies. You've been to metal detecting rally recently, Caroline. And it's a bit eye-opening, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's some very infamous objects as well. John at the back knows quite a lot about this object, I think, from Sally. This is a really infamous case. This is the Crosby Garrett helmet, which is found up in Lancashire. Now, we don't actually know where this object is anymore. And I think if you saw it in the news, you might have seen some of these type of pictures. Now, a metal detectorist found this, and it was in 63 pieces. I think it was 63. And he took it to an auction house and said, I found this really important object. How much is it worth? So it was valued at £300,000. It then went in the news with this sort of traction talking about it, pushed the price up a little bit further. It then went to auction. And Tully House wanted to acquire this piece, and they had £1.7 million in the bank to buy it. It went up to £2 million at auction, and with the hammer price, it went to 2.3. And it's been bought by a private collector. We don't know where it is. It's not gone out of the country as far as we know, because no one's applied for an export license. But it could have left the country. We just can't tell, because anyone can smuggle it out in a crate. Then we've got other famous objects as well. Now, I first saw this one in a pub in Oxford, and I thought, well, that's a nice ashtray. I wonder where that came from. It's actually a triller, so it's a saucepan. It's missing the handle and the bottom. But around the edges, it's got inscriptions, places and names. So it's got four of the Roman forts, and it's got the individual's name and a further place name. So you can find this online. If any of you are online at the moment, you can actually go to this address at the bottom and find it. And you've got zooming images and the inscription around the outside. Please do have a look if you want to. And this is one of the typical records in the database. So this is a record on the database of the passerelle. So we've got multiple high-resolution images. Any of you can download these as well. I give away our images. There's no restrictions about who can download them. We're just worried about you saying where you got them from. And it's actually worked really well. We're finding our images used all over the place, and we get credits. If I find some people don't use them, I usually write them and say, could you just credit us? And they write back and say, yeah, sure, sorry, I didn't realise. Even though there's a big Creative Commons licensing participation. And we also use multiple formats as well. I'm sort of a computer geek, at least my wife thinks so. And so I like doing stuff in various different formats. So who knows what QR code is in here? A few people, I should think. They're not used in mainstream stuff at the moment. Lots of advertising got it on. If you've got a CodeCam, they've probably got a QR code on now. I'm using them in a slightly different way to most people. I'm using this for cataloguing. So someone gets an object, they can print out the record and stick that QR code onto their object. Then they've got a scanner on their phone, they can pick it up and scan the object's code, and it's taken directly to the web page as well. So they've always got the information for it. And I've actually made sure that if we change our URL structure, there's a redirector. So we've got permanency of URL. We also pump out data in XML. Charlotte's quite familiar with XML after some of the projects we've worked on. And we also use something called JSON as well, portable JavaScript object notation. So you can use all sorts of different web pages. And I'm very free about giving our information away. So if you want to use any of the information on our website, just take one of these formats at the bottom of the page, see which one's best for you, and use it. I don't mind if you don't tell me about it, because it's got a thing in it that says where it came from, already built in. So why is spatial data so important to what we're doing? Well, provenance is key. Now, if, say, one of you comes to us and says, I've got this really important object, and I'm a museum curator, and I want to buy that object, the first thing I should really ask is, where did it come from? Next thing I should ask you really is, did you have permission to actually acquire it from the land if you found it? Because you don't want to take on something that's stolen or has been looted. If they haven't given you a provenance, you don't know about the context. Now, most of the objects that we get brought to us have been found in the plough soil, so it's disturbed. It's not archaeologically given the context, it's not sealed. So we've lost some information already when it's been ploughed up. But at least one of the spatial coordinates can tell you where it came from. So you can do broad brush approaches, which is what John's student has been doing, looking at broad brush approaches to sites of Roman things in Warwickshire. Now, Indiana Jones once said that X never ever marks the spot. Now, he was proved wrong in that film. And we did get lots of criticism about our website, saying it's a big treasure map. and I take big steps to make sure that the information is not available in very high resolution to the public. So say you've got out border detector and you go to a website and go, oh, I know where I can find stuff. You can't precisely find out where things are from unless you've got research rights. So if HFED comes to me and says, I'm doing a really big project at the moment and I want that information, I then go to Charlotte and say, can I have a reference for HFED? I get that reference and then I sign them up and they have research rights with all the grid references but no personal details for the finders. So they can't go to their homes and say, where did you find this? Did you steal it? You know, really hassle people about where things come from. But one of the big things that we've got to worry about with whatever work we do is engagement. Are people using our resources? Now, I think they are. 200,000 visitors last year. We've got 56 staff. So we are getting people to come to use it apart from our own staff. They're looking at 11.4 pages per visit. We've got nearly 3,300 users now registered for research and putting objects on. The public can now record objects as well. We've got 259 research projects, which I'm going to start talking about in a minute, to try and show you how people are using information. And we've got 725,000 objects. There's quite a lot of objects out there now. There are estimates saying that there's millions of objects being found a year. I think they're slightly incorrect at the moment. But we can't record every single object. There's only 56 of us. It takes a long time to record an object. Caroline records objects as part of her job, or I record objects as part of my job. And we've got other things to do as well, like come and do these talks, or go to lunch. So these are just two examples of public and professional recording. So on your, just on this side, this is a public record. On the far side is one by one of our best FLOs. There's actually not too much difference in standard now. We give them training, we tell them how to take photos. Frank Bass from the Isle of Wight takes lovely images. He's actually put up guidance about how to take the images on our website. We're now finding people use those guidelines and produce really good records. And this gives you an idea of one of the maps of the find spots as well. And then maps are really good for me. I can find out when people are making spatial errors as well. You can see one on the map now. There's one in the North Sea. Quite often, that's because someone's got the grid references incorrectly round the wrong way. So they've either got the prefix back to front, or the two eastings and northings round the wrong way. So you can change them around and work out if it's incorrect, or you can go back to the finder and say, are you sure you found it in the sea? Sometimes they are from the sea. We've got objects that have been dredged up around the Solent. And then you can export things into Google Earth as well, directly off our database. Some of you might know the figure in this picture. It's Andrew Burnett at the British Museum at the Roman Society Day. We all dressed up as Romans and walked around the museum. So he dressed up as Vespasian. This is just a map of Vespasianic coins. You can also take the data off our website and import it directly to Google Maps as well, just by doing a search. So you create a search on our website, you take that URL, and you paste it directly into Google Maps' search box, and it brings you up this page with the images, the dots, and stable URLs as well. So you can embed this map onto your own website. So say you lived in Linton in Cambridgeshire, and you run a parish website. You could take that map straight into your parish council website, and you've got maps of all the discovery in your area, but degraded to 1 kilometre squares, if you're allowed to see that find spot. So it is incorrect data in many ways, but it does give you an idea of what's been found in your region. Now, if you're a researcher, you get the full grid references, but they won't appear on your website, because you're not logged in. If you're logged in at the time and you're viewing your website, you will actually get pages with the full grid references. One of the most important things as well is an image. Now, if you've got a description of an object, it's so useless if you've just got the text. You're thinking in your brain, I can't really imagine that. So we really encourage our staff to take a picture of every single object that they encounter. Now, I'm using something called Zoomify to display the images on the website as well. We take static images and they're available, but we've also got high resolution zooming images as well. So you can see how small that coin is just by the centimetre scale. So you can play that up on the screen to, I think it's about 15 to 20 times the size if it's a nice image. If it's not a very nice image, usually 2 to 3 times. We try and encourage everyone to do it at 300 dpi minimum. Sometimes it's a little bit hard though, because some of our FLOs work in very sore, poor bandwidth areas. Especially in Norfolk, we find that they can't upload anything more than 300 kilobytes in size. So the images there aren't great. I'm now working on other ways of getting around this, so perhaps getting a hard drive sent to me with the full resolution images, and I can upload them from there. It's not ideal, because it gives me more work to do, and if I'm not around or leave, someone else has got to take that burden on. And this GIS plot just gives you a different perspective of how many coins are being found in this country. You probably can't see the colours from where you're sitting, I don't think, very well. When it goes on the web, you can see the map much better. We've got some biases, I think you can see prevalent on the map now. So there's areas of Britain where things aren't being found. So you've got the southwest, Wales and the north. Now, you can probably think of reasons why things can't be found in those areas. So in the southwest, there's National Trust land, there's Bodmin, there's Dartmoor. There's areas where people can't go and detect, because I mentioned that earlier. Or special sites of scientific interest, you can't go detecting there either. Then you've got the fens. Was there any habitation there at that point? So do detectorists go out on the fens and look for objects? Then you've got areas that were heavily wooded as well, so down in Kent. You've also got detector bias. So say I live in Dover, I might only go 10 miles from my house because I'm lazy. I don't really want to go very far. Or I might drive hundreds and hundreds of miles to go to a rally. It depends on the circumstances of the finders. This map just gives you an idea of the integration of Peter Guest's work that I mentioned earlier. So the black dots are from Peter, the red dots are from our scheme. So you can see we didn't actually have very good coverage of Roman coin finds in Wales. There's lots of areas we'd never actually got any information. Until we imported that, if you were trying to do research on our database, you never got a really good picture, so you'd have to go and look at two data sets. You can now query both of them in the same place. We are the only national database for archaeological objects in the country. There's something called Heritage Gateway up there for historic environment records, but not everyone's put their data onto it yet. Hopefully in the future, you will be able to do it nationally, and it makes it one-stop shop for researchers. They don't have to go out to a filing cabinet in the middle of nowhere and try and open all the drawers and find the objects. Now it's all digitally online, they can actually use our data. So these are just going to be a few examples of research that's been completed recently. Some of you might know Philippa Walton, who is at the Institute of Archaeology. And she's been looking at Roman coins. She hated Roman coins when she first started working with the scheme. And then she realised that she could actually do a PhD on them. So she did all this work for 3 years looking at Roman coin clustering. And she came up with some conclusions via her work. So she looked at certain things like Roman and Republican coins. When did they arrive in Britain? I think you can read the conclusions on the screen. When and by whom were Claudian copies used? Where the cement is? And this is a big question from the universities. It's still not answered by her thesis. And then there's the Isle of Wight, transforming the understanding of coin usage down there. And Piercebridge, up in Northumberland, she's been looking at the deposition of objects in the river over a long period of time. I think we've got thousands and thousands of objects that have been thrown into the river as a voting deposit. Then there's Tom Brindle's research, which John Pierce is sitting in the room, supervised. Now he used a methodology to tell you what a site was, using a 200 metre buffer. So up here, you've got three of his sites as a cluster. Then on the right, there's a map of some of the sites that he managed to identify around Roman town. This gives you an idea of Roman sites in Wiltshire that he managed to identify via the Portal of Antiquity Scheme data. So he found, I think it was 48 new sites in Wiltshire that weren't known to the HER officers. So we're increasing knowledge of the historic environment by doing this work. Now you could query his methodology. I think it was pretty sound. I think John thought it was sound as well, because it passed. And then there's my boss's work, Roger Bland. He's been looking at single Roman gold finds in this country. Now, they're actually quite scarce. I have to look at my notes on this, because I don't know very much about his research. He did some work with a chap called Xavier Loureau from France, and they've been looking at the single finds. There's 726 single gold coin finds, Roman coins, since 1500. So they're not very, very common. Considering how many Roman coins have got in the database, you could do a predictive model about where things are found. And there's reasons why things are being found, and an explosion. So he's got one peak in 1850 to 1950. He thinks that's based around development work, so people rebuilding things. And there's hiatus during the war, when people were out fighting, so they weren't finding objects. And he thinks the same thing about wards as well. And then in the latter part, there's a big explosion upwards. And he says that's due to the Treasure Act coming into force as well. People are now reporting these hoards, because they're now being rewarded market value. They're not hiding them and selling them off in small snippets. And then also, he's quite interested in UK finds compared to the continent. Now, we're quite lucky the way we're recording objects. No other country in Europe is recording objects in the same way. So we've got this big database. So this could be skewed as well. The fact that we recorded them, we've got a big record. Doesn't mean things aren't being found on the continent, just that we've got the information. So we get the benefits of that. Then you've got sources of gold coins as well. You've got several databases in this country. You've got the Celtic Coin Index, you've got the Roman Coin Project from Wales, you've got the Portal Antiquity Scheme, and you've got the Early Medieval Coin Corpus at Cambridge as well, Fitzwilliam. So this graph basically shows you the Portal Antiquity Scheme is actually the most successful way of actually getting information about single gold coins in this country. I mentioned earlier about finders and where they're based. We've got a PhD student at the moment based at Southampton University looking at biases in data collection. She actually looked at one county, this is Hampshire, as you can probably tell from the map. She worked out where people lived. I'm actually going to have to take this slide out of the presentation at the end, because it's got finders' names on it. You can work out where they went based around the colour of the dots. So you can see that some people, especially the one in purple, can you see the purple? Possibly. The person with purple, he goes all over the place. The whole county he goes detecting. So that either means he's got lots of very good friends in the farming community, or he goes out on rallies and finds good areas to go and find things. So where else do we put information into? There's Britannia. We put some really nice stuff into Britannia, and John's wife works on this every year and produces a really good piece of work. I'm going to show you a few pictures of objects that have been going into that report for the last year. This map just shows you hinged bow and fantail brooches recorded with the scheme, and examples that weren't recorded with the scheme. So the solid black one, the large one, that's Port Antiquities find. Ones with circles, they're ones that aren't Port Antiquities. So you can find a picture where we're actually adding to knowledge where things weren't found before. So you can redo work that someone did, say, 30 years ago, and update it using Port Antiquities data. So you can change knowledge. You can say, actually, that was wrong. Things are being found all over the country. It's not just in that region. We've had lovely objects coming up, like this head. We're not too sure, actually, who it is. There's lots of arguments about whether it's actually real. Sam Moore had picked it up, wanted to lick the eyes, and he said, if you could taste it properly, it's real. We didn't let him lick it. The Ministry of Fun actually loved the scheme as well. It's the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. Ed Vasey came along to our meeting. He actually started metal detecting, which actually isn't ideal in some ways. I think he's found one ring pull so far, and a 2 feet. Yeah, he didn't report those because we wouldn't report them. And there's other lovely discoveries as well. So you've got this spatula handle from Highworth, and then you've got this enamel pan. This is quite similar to the one that I showed earlier, apart from there's no writing around the outside. I think that's in a museum as well now. And we've got animals depicted on the objects we find as well. So you've got Gallienus' zoo on the coins. I quite like Gallienus' zoo. I think it'd make a really good children's book to talk about the animals on those coins. You get brooches in the zoomorphic shapes as well. So you can do all sorts of studies based around the animals found on the database as well. No one's done it yet. If anyone's interested in Roman animal stuff based around a database, you could do quite a good study on those. Now I'm probably going to switch a lot of people off. I'm going to start talking about technology. Some of you might find this interesting. Now, who in the room has used Wikipedia? Most people, I should think. And some of you might know about DBpedia, which is the database behind it. It's an extracted set of information. Now, I started writing biographies of Roman emperors to put on our website. We've got a coin guide. And I suddenly realised I'm wasting my time. Someone's already done this, probably to a better standard than I'm going to do in the time I had available. So I decided, how am I going to do this? So I had to look around and I found Sparkle, which is a query language for querying Wikipedia or DBpedia. And I worked out how to query it and pull out the abstract for each emperor, a picture of the emperor they got uploaded to the Wikipedia, where they were born, a thumbnail as well of, say, a famous place associated with them. And I could work out which language I wanted depending on the locale of the user. So say Gabby wanted it in German and their computer set to German, it automatically works out the language they're querying and it brings the abstract back in German for me. So it's multilingual without me doing any extra work. And it just uses a simple query which is on the board here. I also do lots of text extraction as well. So I run descriptions through something called OpenCallo. I pull back terms and entities out of text. So this is the descriptive text from the Moorland Pan. There's a few things underlined on the screen that you can probably see. So it's worked out there's a person called Aelius Draco mentioned in the text, because that's been in a newspaper and they worked out that it was associated with a name. Then it worked out there's a chap called Guy Delabedia who works on Time Team. So it's worked out he's there. So it puts it into this column over here, which it's got people. And it worked out it's talking about profession, craftsman. You also get some social media terms which you can't actually see on this because it's been cut off by the projector. It worked out there's places called Northumberland, Cumbria, counties of England, Whirligig for the pattern, and the names of the Roman forts. Now I take this out in XML and I put it back into our web page. And you've now got tags to search our database. So anything that's tagged with Whirligig, you'll find everything on the database just by text extraction from that. So it's automatically doing the tagging for me. I also use something called YQL. This is Yahoo's query language. It's very like SQL, which is a database query. And I can do lots of powerful things using their language. You can query the Ordnance Survey dataset. You can query Twitter. You can query Facebook. You can do all sorts of stuff based around single searches. And it stores it on their server as a cached copy for 15 minutes. So it saves me a lot of work. I can find objects within bounding boxes based around, say, MPs' constituencies using this YQL language. It's very simple. So there's lots of services out there. There's something called GeoPlanet that Yahoo provide. Now say Gabby records an object and doesn't give me the grid reference because he doesn't actually know where he found it. He went to the pub afterwards, drank too much, lost his notepad with the notes for it. But he knows it came from, say, Elsom. I've now got the place name. I can use YQL to query Yahoo's place database, and they know where the centre of that place is, and they can put a dot on that for me and tell me what's next to that place, postcode for that area, how many people live in that area, all sorts of demographics that you might find useful for research. And I can also find out how high on the landscape it is. So if I'm into doing dots of GIS and view sheds, I could actually do view shed based around the information they give me. It's not particularly correct, but the broad brushwork, as I said earlier, is quite useful. I also did some integration with old ordnance survey maps as well. This comes from the National Library of Scotland. This is a free service, anyone can use this. They scan maps back to 1913, put them online as a JavaScript API. All I did was plug it into our database, and you've now got available to us, you've got all the Google layers. So you've got map, satellite, hybrid terrain. I then put in OpenStreetMap layers as well, historical map, which is the one on screen. And you can actually use Google Earth as well if your browser's plugged into it. So you've got all these different layers that you can query the maps on our database. Some of you might know about the Ordnance Survey Open Data Initiative as well. That happened last year or the year before, I can't remember when they made it open. You can download from them the Gazetteer of the Reign of Britain database, with all the antiquities. I'll pull all that information out and put it into our database. Now say I've gone detecting, I've found an object, and it's quite close to a Roman fort, and I shouldn't be there. It now tells me in our database there's an alert, this person was in, say, 50 metres of the centre of a scheduled monument. We've now also got the outlines of the scheduled monuments in our database. So we can either talk to them and educate them about they shouldn't be detecting there. If they keep going back, you can then pass it on to the English Heritage Scheduled Monument Inspector. They call the police in and they don't do anything. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't, depends on what's been done. So I talked earlier about the DBpedia. Now this gives you an example of our Roman coin guides. These are one of my favourite bits actually of the website. What we've done for the coin guide is we scanned a very high resolution image of a coin, the obverse, so people can find out what they should look like. We've then also got the abstract that I wrote at the top, because I decided I'm going to keep it there anyway. And then below we've got the Wikipedia one as well. So you can match the two up. You might just be able to see the bust of Hadrian sticking outside and covered up. But what we've also done as well, is we've now got examples as they're being found on the same page. So we've got four of the latest examples that have been found. We've got a map of where the finds are being made as well, degraded like I mentioned earlier, unless you're logged in. And you've also got reverse types, denominations issued. So you can learn lots about that emperor's issues of coins just from one page. And we also did the same thing for personifications of coins as well. So for Sol Invictus, I did the same thing with Wikipedia. You can go backwards and forwards. You can find out which emperors issued coins with Sol on the back. So you can learn about coins. And I've done this for every single period in the database. So you've got early medieval coins have got the same treatment. The Iron Age has got the same treatment. That's not working as well because we haven't got as much information. Medieval period is really good. And I then linked all the drop-downs together as well, because I wanted to make sure our staff could actually enter things and get things right. Now, Caroline, in fact, doesn't know very much about Roman coins. So she goes onto our database and says, well, I know it's a denarius, but I'm not sure who might have issued them. So she chooses denarius as a denomination. It then reconfigures the drop-downs that come through for the only the issuers that she can have. It then gives you the Rees period. If any of you new visitors in here, you know about Richard Rees. And he set up a characterisation scheme for periods of the Roman Empire. Sam Moorhead made me put this in. Everyone else resisted, it's now there. We've also got the mints that they issued under. So you make the correct choices. You don't get things wrong. Well, you can make them slightly wrong because you choose the wrong issuer. But at least you can go back and sort out the problem because you know you've got the denarius. So this sorts out the drop-downs I just mentioned. So it just gives you an idea of how it works. So I've chosen Norius at the top because I like the gold coins. So Nero, I like his coins because he's got quite a nice image on them. He's usually either quite young or quite fat, depending on which age he's got. And that just gives you an idea of how to go through. So these drop-downs drive the knowledge pages. So everything's working through one system. I had to recode all of this three times. It's all working off one point of access. And the search engine as well. If you're doing a search for coins, you can't choose the wrong thing. So you're led through. Now, I talked earlier about social media as well. Now, this is something I'm quite interested in, and I'm actually helping Lorna with her PhD on this at the moment. We disseminate information via various social media. Flickr was the first one I experimented with. So I put up images under a Creative Commons license. and they're Wikipedia friendly, they're not non-commercial. So anyone can download these images and put them into Wikipedia or use them for their own work, as long as they attribute where they came from. We've had a really good hit rate on this. I put all the Staffordshire Hall images onto Flickr. I think most of you can probably remember the Staffordshire Hall from media, the early medieval hoard. And we had 1.5 million views of our images in 3 days by putting them onto Flickr, which we wouldn't have had elsewhere. I then pull that, the images from Flickr, back into our website. So I mentioned Andrew Byrne Eccleston was best placed in the earlier. So here he is on our website, Fiona from the Roman Society in Sam. That was quite a fun thing. I had to dress up as a gladiator, it was quite hot. Then I worked out where the image was taken as well. So you've got the map of where it's taken. Also the exit details from the photo as well. So you, if you've written stuff into the image headers, it can actually display that on the screen as well. And you can work out what the resolution is. So that's hidden normally from the public, but I've put that up today. So it's an image resource as well. So if you want images for your work, for publication, you're free to use our images, just cite where they came from. I'm really happy if you do. Everything we do is about dissemination. We also put stuff onto Facebook and Twitter. Well, it's mostly me that does that. But people do integrate and they interact with stuff. Engagement is the big thing. We want people to actually like what's going on there. So I put up a really important Roman coin in the Isle of Wight. Someone said, yes, brilliant. Some people wouldn't like it, but some do. So we're trying to get people who are interested in finding it by all sorts of different means, realise we exist, and actually come back and use our information. And it's working. We also seed Wikipedia as well. Now, we had a Wikipedian in residence at the British Museum. He was there for 3 months. He's now working for Wikimedia in Australia. He introduced me to some people who work for who do Wikipedia stuff. I kept their email addresses, and I write to them now when we've got a big discovery coming up. Say, we've got this really important thing coming out, and it's going to be announced tomorrow. Will you write a Wikipedia page and put it up? And they do. We give them the right information at source. We give them really good quality images. And that page goes up the same day as ours. So we've got more ways into our information. And it's worked really well. We also distribute our data via OAI PMH, which I've always found a bit of a horrible technology. Some people quite like it. Now, this is the backbone of something called UOPR, or Culture Grid, which I think some people in the room might know about. It's an aggregator of cultural content. It's not used overly at the moment. It's got a critical mass. It's got millions of objects in it. But the website's pretty boring, and there's not much you can do with it yet. I think in a few years' time, it'll be really good. So we're now feeding data from our research on the database to lots of different projects. There's Culture Grid, there's UOPR on it. You might have seen a Telegraph article or a BBC article about this new project Chris Gosden's running in Oxford, English Landscape and Identities. And he's taking data from our database, from the early medieval coin corpus, from the historic environment, and he's going to try and predict, as the paper said, that there's a burial ground under your house, which is not actually what he's trying to do at all. He's trying to show you where people lived and the continuity of development over time. And we also give our data to the Historic Environment Records Office. Most of these people are using something called HBSMR, which is written by Exegesis in Wales. That's the top logo. I built this database. It'd be useless if you couldn't actually find anything. I've hoped to make this as search engine friendly as possible. So this is just an example of a search for Honorius of Nero in Cornwall. Plug that into Google. It comes up as the first hit on data on Google. Is actually our website. If you try Honorius of Nero, it comes up first as well. You've got the search results directly off our database. You've got records that come up as well. And you can get a map from one click onto Google as well. So these examples here just give you an idea of how visible we are on Google. Now, I've spent no money on search engine optimization. If anyone writes to you and tells you that they can actually make your website top of the list, just tell them to go away or delete their email. It's a waste of time. You can do it yourself. It's just about writing semantic web pages, writing good descriptions, and having good content, and linking to a few good people. So I've got a few examples here. So Roman, we're second out of 1.25 million. This is for coins. Early medieval, second out of 350,000 search results. And this is all just by doing simple techniques. We then analyse what people are up to as well. I need to work out whether people are engaging with our resources. So we get some unusual lengths of research when people come to our website. This poor person searched for Iron Age coins in Lincolnshire, looked at 186 pages, and was on there for 2 hours 26 minutes. Now, could he not find what he was looking for, or was he really interested? I'm hoping he's really interested, but he might not have been. I've actually found the highest that someone spent on our website looking at Google Analytics is 1,674 pages, picking backwards and forwards, and they've been there for 5.5 hours. It could have been one of our staff. Now, What I'm also quite interested in as well is other gazetteers of data. I'm now interfacing with Pylades database, which I think Leif Isaacson talked about 2 seminars ago, the GATN project. So we can now link our ancient places, or where our finds are found, to ancient places in the Barrington Atlas of the classical world, using their API. This isn't actually public to anyone at the moment, because Sean Gillies asked me not to make it public at the moment, but it's there for the researchers if they want to see it working in action. And we also tried to comply with the NUMISMA data model, which Sebastian Heath is running in New York University. Now, this is using RDFA, which is embedded into the HTML. Now, Sebastian at the moment is actually doing it by hand. Our database is actually crafting it on the fly. So it's a little bit easier for me than it is for Sebastian at the moment. But this will roll out through the whole site at some point later next year. And we're also trying to send out data as well, using something else that Sebastian and a few other people got together and created the British Museum, something called NUDS, Numismatic Database Standard. So we're trying to make sure our XML goes out in a standard format. I can't remember if Charlotte was there for that workshop. So we try and comply with standards. We also send out our finds data, something called Midas XML. So everything I try and do is standardised. So it's building other people's work. I don't want to create something new. I want to reuse the wheel that's already there. And it all goes out under the Creative Commons. So that's it for what I've got to tell you about. So if you want to use our data, please get in touch. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Anyway, my first question, how many hits do you get every week? I mean, do you have any idea?
We get 13,500 visitors a week at the moment.
Wow.
And it varies between 50 and 150,000 pages. From that, was it more? I can't remember. Yeah, 50 and 150,000 roughly.
Oh, that's good.
Really? It was a lot more if you used the old analytical systems. Say you used everything robots built in. Since we moved to Google Analytics, it's come down. So we've got the annual report that's going around. There's a table in that shows this huge hit figure of 13 million hits and all these visitors. And we've recalibrated back. And I'm trying to use the same standard system that everyone else is using in Heritage now. So I'm still quite pleased with how people are coming through.
Well, no, my first reaction really, wow, because you really have a fantastic multifaceted kind of sort of framework. You have the social network, you have the database, you have really a lot of things. But my question is that how much do you think you contributed to the understanding or of the historic environment? I mean, obviously, you have a better picture than many others.
I think we're still a nascent scheme. We've only been around for 13 years. When we first started, when I first joined the scheme in 2003, there were some papers written about standard raw research and the data we were collecting, saying it wasn't very good. We only had 30,000 objects. And now we've got 700,000. I think we're now reaching critical mass. I think when we get to about 1 million objects, it's going to be really useful for people to actually start using as a proper data set. At the moment, we're still tentative about what's being used. I don't think we've really changed too much knowledge yet. Some people might disagree with me, but it's now giving you a framework to start building from. And I think, say, in 20 years' time, you'll look back at what the scheme started doing. And the scheme might not exist in, say, 10 years' time because the government doesn't want to fund it. But at least the results will still be there, and you can use that as a framework to do the research. I think we are starting to change people's knowledge. I think John's PhD student couldn't have done his research without using the database at all. I think that's correct. Really. But it is starting to change people's perceptions about where people lived, what happened, and coin loss is a big thing as well. Working out that Roman Britain might be more rural than we thought, because you're finding coins all over the place.
That's excellent. You can see it from the map. I mean, the distribution is quite extensive. Any more questions?
Just to follow up on Dan's point, Hafed, I think one of the points that came out of Tom's PhD was that, as you said at the beginning, Dan, there are biases in the data set that people, the map of detecting isn't the same as the map of historic settlements in the early medieval period or Roman period, but the biases behind detecting are different from the biases behind other archaeological practices, behind field work, for example. So it does give you an insight into areas that traditionally haven't had very much attention to excavation or survey, so especially sort of Midland and central southern Britain, you know, as opposed to the usual biases to the southeast. So just to take one example. And because the corpus of objects is now so big, quite often you find if you're comparing, taking an individual artifact type, you might have, say, I don't know, 80 brooches of a particular type known from museum collections, excavation and so on, and then up to 20 or 30 from Gay Estate, so often it's adding a significant extra percentage on top of it.
There's Ralph Jackson's article about Pessels, isn't there? That Sally's trying to rewrite with the PS data. And it's showing a completely different picture to how Ralph thinks they were found in this country. And so he's not very happy about her writing it again in some ways. But there's a paper coming out in Antiquity, the next edition, I think, from Andy Bevan from UCL, which talks about Bias's collection. And he's looking at coin corpuses. And he's doing a predictive model about where gold coins could be found. And that's showing some very interesting results. I looked at it last night. I couldn't understand half of it. But it looked very good. They could have done. The Google Analytics doesn't track off-site usage at all. You can do it via events, but I haven't actually enabled that yet because I've never got around to it. But you can take the data away, but you can track the XML usage via logs. And I've never actually looked into that very much because I know there's only a few people who are capable of doing it at the moment.
So you don't know much about people doing away
from the site? No. I know people are embedding images and stuff like that, so you get trackbacks, so you can see what people are up to.
What would be the next tools that you'd like to provide for people
to
work with data on the site?
Well, I've been working on RDF and trying to make it more link-based friendly, but I think the community for that is still quite small, and it's whether I can actually spend the time doing that, because that's only me working on the project on the IT side, whether I'm going to get any return or benefit from actually finishing it, apart from for, say, two people at the moment, or say the project you're working on. Which way it could be useful, but there's not enough resources to actually complete it in many ways at the moment. I'm trying to do all this stuff at the same time.
Have you got any kind of, would you like to have sort of image compare, overlay, that kind of thing?
I think researchers would. So say there's new visitors in the room who looks at dyes, they want to work out where the coins were made in the same dye. They'd like that sort of thing. But I think a lot of our images aren't always brilliant quality, and they're incomplete images as well. So Caroline's been calling posy rings. Quite often they're broken. So you're going to be comparing half an object with a full object. So it would be useful, but it'd have to be on demand, really. I know the tools are out there. And annotation of images as well, that's quite useful.
Seems to me that you could do with the equivalent of an editorial board review. You presumably have to have academic publications. In other words, some people come in and have a look, see where you are, and what you could look for in X number of years.
We've had reviews every 2 years under MLA, but they've usually been about the public engagement with the scheme. We had Hilary Coolrace review back in 2001 of our data, and she said it wasn't particularly useful. I don't think we've had one done since, apart from the researchers using the information. I think there could be one coming soon. But I agree there should be an academic review whether data is useful at a high level.
To encourage you not to.
Yeah. Oh, we know we've got to improve in certain areas. I think we can't kid ourselves we're doing everything right.
If someone's setting up a small provincial museum, say, all those little clustered places all over the country that have got little bits of stuff in them, very often with quite a lot of, well, at least a general sense of provenance, they come from that village or whatever. Would they go to your site in order to find out how to set up a catalogue? Would you be a guide to such people? Is there a link, is there a potential interface between you and your stuff that's being reported and stuff that's being collected in other ways?
Possibly, not particularly sure about it, never even thought about it. One thing I have been doing recently is turning all our code for the website into open source so that anyone else could download our system and say they acquired some of those objects, they could actually port that information into their website themselves and they could use it to supplement the information about what they've got in their own collection. So you could actually say, well, we have got, say, 100 Roman coins found in our village, which are in the collection, but detectorists have found another, say, 1,000. And we can have a map in the gallery that shows you where they were found. You could do that sort of thing.
Yeah. It would seem to me that that's kind of the next the other relationship is with, because there's a lot of fairly prominent stuff sitting about with little handwritten labels in funny old places and kind of not getting anywhere.
I think there's also a lot of information in museums where we're not really sure where it came from.
Well, true.
So
there's much more that people don't know.
I think Jonathan knows this with the Merlin database we talked about the other day, which you'd like to put everything on a map, but you can't, can you? Because you've got, say, found, where was it? Suriname, but it might be in India, not sure.
Yeah.
So it's a bit wishy-washy, some of the information. Whereas we're trying to get absolute points of discovery, and it's all based on trust. So say Kate comes into me and says, I found it here. And you go, well, I don't really believe them, but I've got to go out and check that blind spot. I'm not allowed in that land because the landowners said so. You can't go and check. But I think it's all implicit trust, everything we do, really. We can't doubt our finders. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a relationship. And the scheme wouldn't exist in the way it is with 19,000 people coming forward now. So it's worked because we actually have trusted people. We've built up relations. And I think before the scheme came along, archaeologists and metadetectorists were pretty much at loggerheads. There was the stop campaign back in the 70s. And there's still people who don't want detectorists doing work. But they are bringing knowledge forward now. And we are criticised because one review said that it should be a partnership between archaeologists and metadetectorists. But it's never really felt that way for me, as if it is a full partnership. It's more a relationship where we report the objects they find so that we benefit and public benefits, and they still can do their hobby.
I think this is a really positive step because we have to be friends with the metadetector people. Otherwise, they will be working outside our room, and we have a problem with. I mean, I remember working with one of the British Museum sites in Estonia, in Finland, and a few times we have people at a detector with shotguns before we actually started digging. And the British Museum decided to put nails, so to in order to divert them. Till later,
which doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work. But later, sort of reached a consensus that we work together and allow them to use the spoil heap to go through, and then they hand the material to you. But really, this is a positive step that we work together with the medical tech people.
But we have talked about you could export the scheme's ideas to other countries, but the laws are quite often in place where you can't do it. But it doesn't mean that detection doesn't happen in those countries. So Cyprus, for instance, they have a big problem with looting. Sam Hardy at UCL wrote his thesis about looting, I believe, in Cyprus. And I think you must have stuff being looted in Libya, with just by people finding stuff when they're out in the fields or doing stuff. And you would love to have that information as an archaeologist on a database. So in theory, I'd like to be able to make my code usable in any country where they wanted to use it. And I'll just give it away. I'm not going to try and make money from the museum of it.
But the Antiquity Act actually has really helped a lot, because I mean examples of Libya, because there's no real policy of compensation, real compensation, people will see it. They take it to the Department of Antiquity, it will be not compensated adequately. So, but I think the Antiquity Act 1997 made it quite clear that it should be compensated only.
I've got to say, it still caused problems a lot for Caroline and her team. People aren't happy with the rewards they get paid quite, and you do get a lot of abusive letters and emails and phone calls that say you're ripping me off, and they feel they should be rewarded more. But when you think about it, they're paying for their own rewards because it comes out of British taxes. And which year was it where we paid out millions?
2009 was such a hard term. There was another 2.25 million there.
And there was another big reward as well that year, wasn't there?
Yeah.
But most detectorists won't make it rich. Is it about £150, £50 roughly?
The average valuation is between £50 and £200 for detector objects. Most years, minusing a year like when we had Sasha Hoard, a year's worth valuation is usually just about £1.2 million maximum.
And there's 900 cases roughly now?
Yeah, about 900 cases a year. About 45-50% of those are valued and acquired. So.
There's a few prolific finders out there. But usually it's you get one chance making rich as a detectorist. And there was one chap who went detecting on a scheduled monument, he just bought a detective. First time he went out, he found a Roman coin hoard and he took it into our local finds station officer. He said, where did you find it? He showed him on the map and he said, oh, we've got a problem here. It's from a scheduled monument. I either tell the scheduled monument inspector or you surrender it. So he did. And he lost his reward, which would have been.
I don't know because he surrendered it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But has he given up?
I mean, you do get some, I think, especially from the media that we get as well. We had a case a couple of years ago of a gentleman who he bought a Bronze Age axe sword on eBay. I think he was from the Netherlands, if I remember rightly. And then once he bought the board, it obviously gone out without an export license. But he was doing a bit of research on the axes and came across our site and realised actually this was a potential treasure from England and he shouldn't really have bought it. So he shipped it back to England to the British Museum, where we put it through the process and he donated it to a local museum because he was able, from his basic view of this object, to realise the law.
Was that the famous budgie case? With the family that got the divorce over a budgie and the axes. Look it up, you can find it on the web. But you have problems with people on the foreshore as well. Lorna's worked with some discovery projects, and you have to ask people if they've got permits as well when you're down there to make sure that they're allowed on the foreshore. So there are places where you do need permits to go out, not just permission. So you can actually query people's actions when they're out on the foreshore. But what stuff come up from your down there from Detectorists?
What stuff comes up on the foreshore all the time, but we also get people who quite blatantly on the foreshore in front of the Tower of London, for example, and the police are going past in their little patrol boat completely ignoring them.
But I think that's one of the problems in this country is the heritage police and laws, they're a bit, is it worth their while, I think is what a lot of policemen think. The convictions are quite low. So we had a seminar with the Chief Inspector from Kent, who's on the Commonwealth of English Heritage, and he said he'd rather try and arrest someone for another law that they've broken. So they can go out of the house after raid them, and they might have pornography that's been copied or fake DVDs, and then they can arrest them for counterfeiting or money laundering, and they'd rather get them under that than the Treasure Act. But there's another interesting case the other day about a man fighting in a pub and breaking a jukebox, and then it says, and he's offered his object, which is gold, as a compensation to the owner of the pub. Now, as far as we know, it's not going through the Treasure Act. So he could have broken the Treasure Act law there as well. So we have to tell the coroner to go and investigate now. And I don't know if that's got anywhere yet.
No.
It's an interesting field to work in. I love working in the museum. I can't really think about doing anything else at the moment.
I think this is a really global problem. And now there's a lot of people discussing that we should have, in many countries, a magistrate specialised in heritage. So because, if you steal a coin, you take it, will be, you discover a coin, golden coin, will be treated like a sort of its weight of gold or whatever. But if you have a heritage magistrate, which people specialize in heritage, it will be sort of looked at in a different way. And that's just adding another point to Charlotte is, I think syndication of data is another sort of area which would be useful to put up efforts in it. So you could, the data you produce might be, or it could be syndicated to people like students, researchers, and people could use the data. I think Gabby done that in the inscriptions. Mm. You could actually give the whole data if you want. Use it, but obviously you have some restriction about the provenance.
But you could take most of it out, you could do really high level work around it. But the idea is about syndication, about taking our data out, and it's serendipity about using it. So I don't know what people are going to use it for. I just make it available. And someone in this room might build this most fantastic database using my database, and there's nothing I can do about it apart from go, wow. So, and I'd be quite happy if they did, actually. So
I was going to ask, do you know of anybody who has done it?
Your friend Sean Gillies, he's done some stuff based around the Celtic Coin Index that I rebuilt. So he did some of the planning applications around Cambridgeshire, just as a demonstration. There's a few other people using it within their websites as well. But there's not been a huge take-up. It's whether people are actually that interested in using our data at the moment, or whether they're aware.
I think it's a concept that people find very difficult. Mm. I find that if you use the expression, do you use this data, it's kind of semantically meaningless to people at the moment. They think, so what do you mean? It may be that in a few years' time, but we need more examples of the reuse of data, easily understood examples, so that you can say, please use my data like this.
Yep.
look at the way these people have done something, but people need a bit, I mean, I think it's terribly important to get what's politically important to get the data reused. I think that's all part of the, you know, how do you stay in business.
Yeah. That's one of the things I did with this database. I said to, well, I didn't even tell Roger, I said, I'm going to make the data available in as many formats as possible and hope that someone might reuse it.
Yeah.
And I think now we're starting to realise that it's a really good way of sharing it. In fact, you can download spreadsheets or you can take XML out. Mm. And we said, oh, when's someone going to start building things? Or why aren't they building this stuff using our information yet? And then, say, Chris Gosden finds out that you can use the data in XML. And he rings up and says, I've got this big project, I've got 2.6 million euros to build a big database of where things are found in this country. Can I use your stuff? And Roger says, yes, you can just take it without actually having to give it to him. Mm. But it makes a big difference. The information is available. Brian's going to take it.
Yeah, I might have missed, the entire talk, sorry.
You're ready.
Did leaked data come into it at all?
Yes.
Okay, so
I mentioned that.
One thing we're thinking about doing next year at the Institute of Archaeology is having a hackathon to using the Institute's data.
Gabby organised, did you help to organise that camp? Was it last year? They did it around culture data there, and how many hacks got built at that?
I don't remember.
It was a few, wasn't it?
There was certainly a good few, yeah. There were five honourable mentions. You said you deliberately sort of obfuscate some of the location data. Could be this sort of problem later on that people will want all the data?
Do you mean the research users or
everyone?
Well, I'd quite like to give it all the data away because I'm an archaeologist and I like to know where things are from, and I think like the public would like to know where things are. But say Kate owns that land and it's effectively given to us in trust, and they've given permission for it to be recorded as long as we make it obfuscated. But I think, say, in 20 years' time, maybe we could release a bit more of it, or 10 years. But researchers could come to say, can I have it all? So Andy Bevan said, can I have all your data? So I could do some really interesting research. I just went, yep, here you are, give it to him. So as long as I know what they want to use it for, I'm very happy to give all that data away. But I suppose it's a bit like we were saying earlier. You give the data away, you've got no control over what someone does with it. So you could build something really nasty based around what I give you, if you were that minded.
Now, I was thinking more of a smartphone.
Yeah, I'd quite like to see that. There's a few people out there who've been given money. There's Culture24 who've given £50,000 by DCMS to build a smartphone application based around where the nearest museum was to you. And I thought, what a waste of money that is, because you can use Google Maps now to do that sort of thing. But it'd be really nice if you could go out to the community and find out what archaeological sites are near you. But I don't think we could give the data to them to use for that, because then you go, right, I've worked out where Stony is, and there's all these archaeological finds found in the vicinity, so maybe there's more of the Roman town over there, let's go and start digging more holes in it. So there's discovery is a big problem.
The trouble is as well, I think quite often the methods that users, if they heard that you were going to do that, they're very protective. That, you know, that's my field. I don't want anyone else to know that all my findings are coming from this field.
Fair their fight over it.
And it's voluntary for them to report, and I think they would start to withdraw.
Yeah.
Have you noticed an increase in metal detecting in similar areas since you've been putting the geolocation online? So are people using it to go and find more stuff in places?
I think there are instances, but it's not a huge amount, because like Kate just said, it's a parochial nature over the land. So say Kate has got permission for that farmer, Caroline then goes along and says, can I have permission as well? And then they find out there's two of them on that land. They do end up having fisticuffs over that land. And so there's sort of ownership of who's got detection rights. So it's quite hard for there to be more and more detectives going to certain areas. It's more rallies, I think, probably for us. So you have a field that a farmer says, well, you can go on my land. You pay £5 or £50 to go on it, and then someone says go. All these detectives go out to fields and find lots of objects. And then the finds those objects then gets given, say, a bag of 500 objects, which could be a year's work for some of them, after one day, and to record them. So they can mine sites quite heavily. There was, I don't know if you can remember, Dura Breve, which is up near Walton Eaton in Cambridgeshire. It was on BBC One with Neil Oliver doing the presentation, I think, a couple of years ago. And they showed a rally in practice. And it's a bit scary. You've been to some recently.
Yes.
And I think it must be quite daunting.
It can be, yeah. And even when you're there on the day, you might want to get these bags and bags of finds. Even on the day, you have like a map printed out saying where you can find them. their negotiation going, well, buy a hedge. Is it that hedge? And they're like, Mick, is it that hedge? Is it to the left of the toilets or is it to the right of the toilets? So even while you're there on the day, it's very hard to get specific data. And as an archaeologist on Valleys, you kind of, though you're there to record, you kind of take a step back. You really can't be out there in the field looking over their shoulder, because otherwise they won't allow any recording to go onto the Valleys either, you know, ever again. So they'd kind of be there and kind of guidance give you as close of a reference as you possibly can, but not, this certainly not be like the man coming down them and hanging over their shoulder whilst they're digging the hole. So it's a,
that's quite a good example. I'll give you an example of some of the good reference recording for that. Ask a question that I'll bring up.
I was going to say, in terms of the actual recording, for image recording, what does that involve? Like photography using...
On site or...
Yeah, when you're actually out there.
If you're doing a rally on site, we ideally have three or four people, usually a couple of FLOs, two at least. And we basically have a production line going on. It's handed to the first person. They get the basic details down as the second person. They'll do a further ID. Third person takes, finds what details. The fourth person, we have a tripod setup going on, and we do photography there and then, as much of the objects as we can, because we have to give it back to them 5 minutes later. So it's a full production line with light boxes underneath them, tripod and scales, as much as you can get, but quickly.
Because I'm just wondering about that last one, the photographic element, and I think Grammar Roll has been in touch with you. RTI, but I'm wondering if there's scope for doing, you know, getting a dome out there and also getting this ultra, you know, super high quality images that might increase the usability of the photographs you do get. Yeah, some of them are
ideally,
it's 3 minutes to capture one, two of them, yeah, 3.5 minutes to do a single capture with the system we have, for example. So it's just a little bit longer than photography, but for selected objects, it might be ideal, complex surfaces.
I mean, we do, if you're on a rally and something comes up that is significant and something that you would like to take away and do further research, so you try and take your IKEA bag full of books that you can ideally leave there on site. But if there's something significant that comes up, you try to do as much negotiation as possible to say, can we take this object away? We would like to do further in-depth research, would like to do better photography of it, etc., etc. But obviously, the 3D photography is ideal for certain, I mean, we were talking about in terms of some of the Sasha Ford objects as well, and there's a possibility for that. I don't think it ever came about whilst we were doing the Sasha thing, but I think bearing in mind potentially be further.
See, not in detail, you only have one chance of around Monday that you can get, because there is some image that Kingston worked up in Liverpool, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
All that you can see. With RTI,
it is an option. I think it's just having the chance to do it and the technology available to people on site, and the fact that they're carrying, say, well, those big books that I bought in. You take those with your rallies, you take all your finds, books, so you can actually work out where things are. And I think some of them are actually quite overloaded when they go there.
Yeah.
I've just brought up this map because Caroline was talking about rallies, and you probably see it's a problem straight away. On that rally, did they really find stuff in that building? With the detector? All down the side of the road? So like Caroline said, they found it by a hedge, so they just pointed to where it is in the map.
Mm-hmm.
But you can actually see how accurate some of the find spots are. There's colour coding as well. We've got a workflow system. John's wife is one of our finds advisors, and they validate the objects. If they think an object is okay, they publish it, which then means it's sort of been checked by an expert, it should be okay. The green dots are the ones that are checked, the yellow ones are the ones that haven't been checked but are available to the public. Now, you can see there's many more yellow dots. We've now got, say, 200 objects going on a day. We've got 90,000 going on a year. We've got 5 staff who do the checking. There's no way you can do it. When we first set it up, we didn't realise how many objects were going to go off the database. They can't cope now. So I think the FLOs, the finds agencies, are now quite competent. So anything that's on yellow, hopefully is correct. If there's any problems, you can go on a record. That's one of mine. It's a bit slow and wild, isn't it?
So Dan, we've talked a lot about metal detecting, and with the popularity of it, does this mean that there's nothing left for non-metal objects?
We record
files with spanning and stuff.
No, we do record those as well.
Yeah,
taking them in.
Are you getting money in? What sort of proportion do you get that are non-metal?
Can I bring that slide?
very
low. If you have a look in that report on desk there, there's a breakdown by object class. I think it's near the back. And it is around 80% metal objects. But then we've got flints that are being reported by field walkers. And we've got pot that they bring as well. Quite often they notice the pots on the surface and they think it might be a Roman tile. So they do read books and work out what things might be associated with. And so some of them are working out there might be in Roman settlements there based around the pottery. And they've realised by talking to our fellows, or say Caroline at a rally, that they should bring that pot in as well and record it, because we might want to know what's there and it's telling us about a new site. We might even be able to go and excavate, but we can't excavate every fine spot. It's really impractical, but we can record that knowledge. But yeah, we are getting pottery coming forward.
I think a lot of it is, especially the first time metal detectors are reporting things, it's talked to them about the significance of type objects. I mean, I had a conversation a couple of months ago with a gentleman who found a Roman coin hoard, and he called me up and we were chatting about it. I was saying, oh, the report's nearly ready, we're just giving a breakdown. I said, oh, yeah. What about the pot? I don't think there was any pot for this. Oh no, it's a bag under my bed. I don't even want that as well. because people see the things like coins important, pots not important.
Shiny gold.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the pot is really actually quite important.
Yeah. I like the pot better than coins
myself. There's in Lorna's project last week, we got one of the conservators to write up a blog post about the conservation of the frame hoard and other objects in the museum. Let's see if we can find it. This one's actually another find that came through the museum. This is a set of bronze patchwork cauldrons that were found in a field. Can't remember Chiselden, but I can't tell you exactly which Chiselden it is. And they were found on a Saturday, and the guy rang up for his local archaeological unit, and no one answered the phone. So he then went on Britart, which is the mailing list, and started ranting about how useless archaeologists were, and no one would come and help him. So he parked a tractor over the top of the hole, because he backfilled it, and waited for someone to come and excavate it. So this is the Froome hoard being cleaned at the moment. There's a contract being made by our department and the conservation department, and it's using money that's come out of, I can't remember who gave us the money, can you? Lottery, museum, something like that. And they've got two conservators working for 18 months on these coins. They've got to clean 40 coins a day. It's actually going in an acid bath and a bit of mechanical cleaning, but don't tell anyone that. And here's a picture of them actually reconstructing the pot. Now the pot's about that tall, about that wide, and it's in pieces. When they took it out of the ground, they had to break the pot to get the coins out. And there's a video as well of the hoard coming out of the ground, which I can show you. Should I call it the Froome hoard? Oh, if anyone watches Time Team, they might recognise this guy's drawing style, actually. That's Luke Drambrus, and this is his interpretation of how the coins put in the ground with the Froome hoard.
I think it's about public engagement. One of our colleagues, Hilary, was saying there's an old axe hoard that was found in Cornwall. I can't remember the name of it. But a local poet in the area just published a poem about this hoard, and it's history and its effect on the local community. It's quite interesting, actually. We're asking the rights to put it up on the database, because it's public interaction with the objects that come up is quite fascinating.
I'm just trying to find the video of it.
Was it Hilary Orange?
Yeah.
Yes, because we were picnicking on the heath one day and we saw a metal detector go past.
Is that when you challenged and she wouldn't talk to you?
Yeah, Hilary wouldn't talk to her, and she said, it's okay, it doesn't matter, no one's bothered.
And they're just little huts, and it turns out they have little police walkers for their heat.
They've been off after her, I don't know if they found her. I sent them a photo from my phone, she's like this big, spinning back and forth on each
I was trying to find you the video, but you can ask me another question while I'm doing it.
This is actually leads us to, have you thought of expanding a little bit more? Because you're based in a museum, you're working from a museum, surrounded by museum people, doing a virtual museum for some of the objects.
Isn't that sort of what we are?
Huh?
with the database.
No, I mean a structured virtual museum, not a database in a sense, produces a selection or a result of your queries. It's just like sort of a museum about like this object you've been talking about. Sort of an entry or I don't know. I mean, just it looks very attractive to. Anyway,
I'm not sure. Anyway, this is the video of the coin hoard coming out of the ground. It's taken over 3 days, and you can see the pot, and then it being excavated, it being broken down over time. And they can actually tell the layers of where the coins went into the ground as well. It gets quite waterlogged at the bottom.
Oh.
It weighs 2 of me, so you know, I'm about...
They must have put the pot there and put the coins in.
Yeah, that's the interpretation. I think they're possibly evidence of going in the sacks as well.
Oh.
And there's actual layers. There's, after this kind of finishes, I'll show you the diagram. So this is a diagram that, as it was found. So you can see all different context layers of the coins as well, and how they took them out. It's quite an interesting case.
Can you say a bit more about your finder record? As you said at the beginning, I think that you've got a certain number of finders who are now putting stuff on the database as well.
Oh, the public coins.
How does that work? How many of you?
Anyone can register on our database now, which means they can save searches or record objects, but they can only record objects if they contact one of the finder's databases who are based around the country. So someone in Cornwall wants to record. They ring up Anatai and say, I want to record in the database. So they register. We then link their personal data to their user account so they can find any objects they've recorded in the past. They can then go on and start recording objects in the same style that we do, with all the same mechanisms and facilities. And they record the objects. We've now got 140 finders recording. One person's recorded 937 objects in the last year, actually in the last 2 months, by themselves, which is more than most of our FLOs actually manage in a year. So they're just sitting there at night, plugging away, putting their coins or their finds. And it's working quite well, so we're getting extra FLOs, really, or relieving the burden. But the only problem with that is we don't actually get to see the objects. So if there's something really important, we can't actually see it in the flesh. So say the Staffordshire Moorland pan got recorded, we'd have to notice it in our database and then contact them rather than seeing it first hand.
But they have no photographs?
They have no photos, yeah. But we can see it by the photo. Mm. Well, at which point they could have sold it as well. So there's bonuses and there's downsides. But we're trying to open it up to the public and have a two-way dialogue. And it's the engagement factor that is really important. So we're trying to make them feel part of archaeology. So it's public archaeology. We work with the biggest community archaeology project. I never thought that really fitted with what we were. Because we weren't organising community excavations, we weren't organising community-based events. It's more about interacting with the archaeology and trying to make them realise more about why it's important to record. So it's pushing the message that recording is good. And it's starting to go through. So last year we had 4,000 people recording objects, and we think there's about 9,000 people to detect. But lots of detectors don't go out every weekend. Some haven't been out for years, but they've got a detector. They go to the club and they have a beer. It's a bit like my rugby club. We've got, say, 200 people in my team. Only 15 play each week. The rest of them just turn up when they feel like it. So it's not always everyone out there.
And what's the gateway to find things?
300 years is the gateway for recording. It's the same as the treasure act. So anything that's over 300 years old. Let's say you want to find something that's quite important, post-medieval, that's, say, 19th century. Or 18th century, we will record it just because it's important, but we have to use discretion because there's so much stuff in the fields from, say, post-medieval machinery that we just can't record it. But the public has. That's one thing we are using them for, to record the stuff that we don't want to tell them that.
Is that going to be a problem also, that you are looking at the space you can include just whatever anyone wants to put on it?
That's the same as most museum collectors, though. It's stuff the museum wants to collect in many ways. So we've got biases all around, so it's something else that you put to a bias type paper if you wrote about what we've been recording. You might be a post-medievalist who doesn't give a toss about Roman stuff, but only wants to have to do, and you've got a much smaller data set to play with. So you can, if say you wanted us to record that stuff, you can ask us and say, look, there's a really important reason why we should be recording it. And we can say to our staff, please do. But
it seems to me you possibly, or somebody else mentioned a small museum. If I was innocent, like my mother just started volunteering at a small museum, I might tell her to record all of the objects in that museum on your system because it's so open?
Well, our system's really for public discovery. It's not really for objects in the museum. That's the thing. And also things like found articles for excavation, we can't record those either. They've got to go in historic environment records. So we're trying to record accidental discovery. But then methods are not really accidental because you've
been there.
But all these records need to be consistent with one another, because if I'm interested in hand axes, I suppose somebody is, you would want to see all of them, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You wouldn't. You might well want to see them regardless of whether they've been excavated or came from you or were in some little regional.
That's one way, when you said about
aggregation,
the aggregation and this,
yes,
and being able to use our data, so you could be in a museum and you've made your data available for hand access in British Museum and you're in a small museum and we've got them as well. Search them all at once. It's what David Wilson used to refer to as a fistful of portals, being able to get access to everything. And it was popular for a while, then died off, and now it's come back with Europeana, so trying to aggregate all the database.
Well, I mean, as I've said here a couple of times before, Europeana has been
at the moment, it may change, but as I've also said here before, we're not just allowing you to do something we've got there. So are you thinking of, will there be a spot for import? I'll just pull up some accents for you. Just to show you how many have come up. 394. You can do maps straight away. I actually think it's a very good way of working out whether your research question is valid just by doing search in the database and go, I'm interested in axes, is there any point in me actually studying them?
Yeah.
We also use clustering on the maps as well.
Well, you might well then say, these are the regional museums, I'm going to go and look at
them. Yeah. But definitely, because you realise that they're coming up and working in big quantities in Norfolk. Now, so Norfolk's actually a big problem for us because they've got so many objects being reported a year.
Yes.
We've only got a very small percentage of stuff going on. And we're now doing a GISP to try and digitise the whole of Norfolk, HDR and Suffolk in 21 months for the GISP funding that came out. I don't think we've really got a chance of getting the money, but we're going to try and get it. And if not, we go to the HLF and see whether community archaeology type thing might work. Anyway, I'm stopping you guys drinking.
Can I just quickly ask you about your images? Sorry, were they all in Flickr or were they...
No, not all of them.
So your database is still in Flickr?
Some of them are. I put the ones that people would be interested in for publication onto Flickr. We've also got, say, things with people in as well. So I'll try to make it where you see more of the life of the scheme and you might want them for publication in journals about what we do. So I put on the big discoveries like fruit. I put them on there because that's always up 24 hours, whereas my database could go offline because everyone came on. So case in point, the Staffordshire Hoard, I knew when that went live, we built a website in 12 hours for it. We knew that was going to get inundated with connections. We had 2,000 a second at one point, and the server went really slow. And then all the images available on Flickr, so people could view them there as well. And actually, they got so many views, it was amazing. And Birmingham Museum wrote the moon when they found out how many people had interacted with the objects.
Okay, so also it's able for viewers to leave comments?
Yep.
We
get comments. We get some interesting comments. I can bring a few up, actually. It's all moderated by me at the moment. We don't get a huge amount of comments. I find that people...
Comments are a problem.
Yeah, I think if you run a blog, I think you found that recently people don't comment very much on the blogs. They comment elsewhere, like on Twitter or Facebook instead. And so the conversation's gone elsewhere. And it's a bit like G+ has come along, or Google+ has come along now. It's a new platform. Whether that survives or not is a different matter. So these are some of the comments that come up. So you've got people... They're actually really positive comments, mostly.
Oh, you're pulling the comments out there as well.
Yep.
That's not a new database, that's
on Flickr. I can pull the stuff out of Flickr's comments as well, but these are the ones that are going directly onto our database. One's on Flickr. I'm bringing one up in the example, actually. So all these images are pulled back using YQL, which is the system I talked about earlier.
The images are obviously leads us to copyright issues. Do you have any? This is all your images, so.
Well, it's done by a consortium of 56 different organisations. We've got a non-exclusive license to use those images, and we can devolve out who wants to be able to use them. And as long as they're attributed back to where they came from, which is us, basically, and we fund the acquisition anyway of the images. So basically, they're all copyright problematic, usually. Just trying to find. Some of you might have seen this set of gold eagles in the news as well. This is a set of coins found in Hackney. They're American gold dollars. The actual owner of his family is Trace. They didn't become treasure. I'm right for that, aren't I?
Yeah.
Martin Salzbacher.
We were to trace the original heirs. The original owner died. He was interned in a World War II camp. He was a German immigrant. His wife was put in a camp in Isle of Man. And they'd taken the money out of the bank. And he'd asked his brother to bury them in the back garden because he thought the banks weren't safe. Whilst he was being shipped off to Australia, I think. Unfortunately, the house of his brothers was bombed. His entire family were killed. And anybody who knew where these coins were found had died during a bombing in Hackney. The reason we're able to trace it is because we slightly advertised when it went to inquest, because it's such recent history, and a researcher got in contact with us and said, did you realise that in the 1950s a very similar set of coins came up in the Hackney area? And it turns out that with the research, they were from the same mine sites, and the original Mr. Salzbacher had laid claims to the men and the crown had given him those original coins back, and he'd said, oh, there are more, but I'll probably never get them again. His son was now in possession of them, and they were returned to his family.
And he's selling them to pay for the upkeep of the graves of
yes.
his family in Highgate.
Perfect example of how hoards are created. That is the story of a hoard. You just need to put that next to some random hoard. That's exactly the same kind of thing that happened.
Well, Roger always goes back to Samuel Pepys as a good example of hoarding his money in Brampton. And so we always use that in any bid we're putting together. We just asked about comments from Flickr, so I did pull them back into the website as well. So this is one of the really nice images from the hoard. So you've got the tags that are on Flickr, you've got the place where it was taken. Ignore the shapes around the outside, they're meant to be adjacent boroughs of London. It didn't work very well, so I couldn't tear that off. I also tell you what the license is as well. So attribution, non-commercial. Then you've got the comments that came through. They're usually pretty positive. So we did get quite a lot of comments on those images. And they are usually pretty academic. We've actually got that news story I referred to earlier about the Roman discovery in Cornwall. It's a bit of a red herring in where it's been found. Someone's picked up on that in our story, saying it's 40 miles west of Exeter. Now that's Cornwall. And someone's actually said that. So I'll publish it, might as well, because we can't hide stuff. We're trying to interact with the public. And this site will come out at some point. Someone will find out about it. It's going on BBC Two on the Ticket to Britain series. And anyone who knows about landscape will be able to pinpoint that site and go, well, it's there. So we can't hide things. And the Staffordshire Hoard find spot was revealed by BBC on the website. They went out because they showed the fences and the road signs in the background. So you could tell where it was. So we've got a duty of care to the find spots and the finders as well, with what we try and do. But we've got no control over the media.
No control over corners, sometimes I find them, I think information is disseminated through different parties. And whereas Authentic Person of Treasure try to respect the anonymity of find spots, when you have other parties involved, sometimes that anonymity can go out the window, unfortunately. So.
Can I say on your behalf, thank you very much to Daniel for this really fantastic talk.
Thank
and
you.
We wish him good luck and really in this project and more contributions. And I would like to thank as well his colleagues from the British Museum, our colleagues from the British Museum, for all the contribution. And please, can we say thanks to Daniel?